You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Ken Lieberthal. I'm director of the John L. Thornton China Center. It's really a pleasure to welcome you here today for this program on China's low-carbon development. We have two terrific speakers, one speaker, one commentator, but each will be giving substantial substantive remarks. The first is Dr. Qi Ye. Dr. Qi was co-author of the Climate Policy Initiative's recent report, which is a review of low-carbon development in China 2010, and he'll be reporting on that report and its implications. You all have received his bio. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It would take a long time. Let me just mention a couple of highlights. He is currently the, I think it's pronounced Chung Kung, is that correct, Professor? Chung Kung Professor of Environmental Policy at Tsinghua University's School of Public Policy and Management. He's also director of the Climate Policy Initiative at Tsinghua. This is an initiative that now employs 27 people, which is, since it only started a year or two ago, is absolutely startling. He has his PhD in environmental science in 1994 from the State University of New York, taught at in California at Berkeley in the late 90s, has been at Tsinghua for a number of years now. For a year ran the Energy Fund Beijing office, Energy Foundation, I'm sorry, Beijing office. He's a prolific author and especially publishes on climate change science and environmental policy and how the Chinese system affects environmental outcomes in China. Absolutely fascinating stuff. So he will spend about 30 minutes laying out the key essentials of the report that they have done and what the implications are. We'll then have Trevor Hauser come up to the podium. Trevor is director of the energy and climate practice at the Rhodium Group in New York, where he is a partner of the Rhodium Group. He also is a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute right across the street here. He worked for well over a year, but short of 2 years. Is that right, with Todd Stern? Oh, under a year. Okay, under a year. It just seemed like, yeah. Anyway, he worked very closely with Todd Stern on global climate issues for the U.S. Mr. Stern is our special ambassador, as I recall, for global climate change, right? Yeah. And Trevor has written a number of fascinating papers and reports, including Copenhagen, the Accord, and the Way Forward in 2010. So we'll first have Qi Ye for 30 minutes presenting his report and overview. Trevor will then present comments for about 20 minutes, after which we'll have a discussion and moderated Q&A until 12 o'clock. Okay? Without my taking any more time, Qi Ye, please come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. It's truly a great honor to be here in Brookings and present this analysis and evaluation of the low carbon, we call it low carbon development policy in China. With me here today is my colleague Kath and Pat from San Francisco Office of Climate Policy Initiative. And Kath is the director of the U.S. programs, and also my daughter for the first time together with me. She is sitting somewhere in the back. I would like today to just report to you this analysis and evaluation of some of the achievements and challenges of China and its endeavor towards this low-carbon green economy. This very fashionable terms and I'm going to present today is quite a mixed picture, and I will start with something really optimistic, and you will think I'm doing the propaganda here, but I will end up with a less optimistic tone. So what I'm going to go is first I'll go give an overview of this low carbon development in China and some key results in different sectors, six sectors altogether here, and summarize this. And also I would look into the future, I mean, for the next five-year plan, which started earlier this year. So when we, whenever we talk about China nowadays, what we think we know is that China is the largest carbon emitter in the world. This China exceeded the U.S. in 2007 and became the largest CO2 emitter, or the greenhouse gas emitter. And we also know China is the largest energy consumer that started last year in 2010. And the government didn't like this initially. Then later, I think, you know, this is more or less the case. 3.2 billion tons of coal equivalent energy consumption. That's a lot of coal. I mean, that's a lot of energy. And that's just roughly just about 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide. So that's its, which is, when you look at the energy intensity, the energy intensity is, just about 5 times of Japan and 3 times of the U.S. U.S. is not the most, efficient economy in terms of energy consumption, but still the China is 5 times of the U.S. Then we may ask, well, the conclusion naturally comes, is China an inefficient economy in the energy terms or in the carbon terms? Not necessarily. The picture is a little bit complicated when we dig into the details. First of all, if we look at the in physical terms, you know, what does this mean? When you look at the energy or coal used for generating 1 kilowatt hour of electricity, and the bottom line over here, this is being the world the best practice in Japan, and the top line, that's China. Then you can see the gap between the energy consumption for generating 1 unit of power has been shrinking very, very fast. 10 years ago, as compared to 10 years ago, is more than half of that is cut, that gap. Then the power generation sector has become a lot more efficient as before. We can also look at the consumption sector. We look at the buildings, for example. If you look at the buildings, the upper part is for per capita, and the lower part is for per unit, per square meter, the energy consumption or CO2 emission, whatever you want to use it. If you look at the per square meter, China is here, the 28 kilogram of carbon dioxide release per square meter per year. And compared to that to, say, U.S., 87 kilogram per year. So that's a big gap. And compared to, say, Canada, even Japan, Korea, China is much lower number. This is even more true for the per capita, carbon dioxide emission. China's number is 849 kilogram carbon dioxide per person per year, and compare that to United States is just about almost 10 times, 7,500, and Australia 60, my friend, the 6,500, and the world average is 1,326. So even the world average is just about 2 times of the that number of China. So if you look at this consumption sector, you will conclude otherwise. China is very efficient, energy efficient in those sectors. And we can also look at the transportation, look at the fuel economy standards. China certainly have a higher standard than that of the United States, and even higher than that of California. So there are a number of factors that, you know, everybody here know very well. Is one is China is a very coal intensive economy. For the blue part of this is just the coal consumption per year. So natural gas, hydro, petroleum, that takes a smaller share. And there is a good reason for that. And when you look at the energy endowment, the reserve, and China, the 97% of that is coal, and the other 3% being split almost equally between oil and natural gas. So the natural resource endowment is very, very different in China. A lot of people compare the U.S. and China, right? The leftmost panel over there, the blue bar, that's the U.S. Carbon emission, and the red bar is China. The carbon emission in 2007 when China exceeded the U.S. And in the middle one, that's the cumulative emission, of course, the U.S. being much bigger than U.S., than China. And the per capita emission, China still is about a few times of that of China. But the problem is, the CO2 emission in China has been going up really, really fast. When you look at the red line on the bottom, that's China, started in 1950s and all the way to almost now. Then the green line in the middle, that's the global average. So in the last decade, you see this number, the carbon emission in China has been going up really, really fast. I think that's really the key of the issue. You know, why a lot of people are talking about the problems now. It's the problem is the world simply cannot afford that rate of growth for carbon emission. So that's but there has been good news. The good news is ever since 1980, China has implemented a pretty strong energy policy, energy conservation policy. That's resulted in just about 5% per year of declination in energy intensity. That goes all the way from 1980 to the year 2002. However, after that, the problem comes. The trend was reversed because of this heavy industry and because of the growth of the energy intensive industry. So that's why in 2005 the Chinese government decided to have a very, very strong policy to reverse this trend, to reduce the energy intensity by 20% during the 11th five-year plan. So how did that policy go? Well, if we put all these figures together and we see this is 2002, all right, then there is an upward trend. Then in the last 5 years, 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, then the trend has been reversed. I can amplify that trend so you can see 2005 was very high already, 1.23 tens of car, of energy the tens of coal equivalent, and as compared to 2009, for example, that's just about 110. So the 20% target, 20% cut target, is almost met. All right, by the end of the day, is just about a little bit more than 19%. So the target was met for that part. But when we look at different sectors, we see very different patterns for power sector and manufacturing sector. They share a similar trend. For power sector, if you look at the overall emission, and that's shown in brown, then the overall emission has been gone up and pretty fast. But when you look at the concentration, the energy intensity and the carbon intensity, that has been declining also quite rapidly. You see, I mean, this is a result of, you know, a number of key policies: renewable energy law, a lot of new power plants, much bigger, large scale power plants, and the many closures of many smaller power plants. So when you compare those numbers, for example, the power industry, CO2 emissions intensity, so that has been declining from 766 in 2005, 2008, that number is the 716. And you can also compare that for the thermal power generator. So that's even more significant. So I can give you all this data. I don't want to read all this to you. Basically, what happened is that renewable energy, hydro and wind, in particular, have been going up very, very fast. Wind is just about 130% increase per year for the installation capacity. And the generation capacity right now is about 19% of the power is generated using renewable energy. So, there has been a very, very fast, increase. Then, a major policy is closure of the small and inefficient power plant. And during that 5 years, 72 gigawatt of, capacity, the small and inefficient, it was closed down. 72, just give us an idea, is, that is 20% more than the total capacity, total power generation capacity for the entire nation of UK. Right? So that was removed. Replaced them with larger and more efficient power plants. This is a figure for the wind power installation. You can see the wind installation has been going up exponentially. And manufacturing industry had a similar trend. Basically, the overall carbon emission has been going up very, very fast. The energy and carbon intensity has been declining also in a pretty fast rate. And China was very effective in implementing the top 1,000, the most energy consuming industries, enterprises, and closed a lot of the smaller factories. The last year in particular, and there are like 2,000 of them were closed at the point generated a lot of problem and generated a lot of dissatisfaction from the business world. And the 10 key energy conservation projects was also contributed to this overall trend. Then we can also measure this by looking at the energy intensity per unit of industrial value added, same thing. And we gave a number, and the National Development Reform Commission, where the Climate Change Department is, they also provided a number. In the 5 years, their number is 680 million tons of coal equivalent saved during the 11th five-year plan. And that's converted to almost 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide saved. That's compared to the frozen, technology case. So, 1.5 million tons of carbon dioxide, billion tons of carbon dioxide, that is five times as much as the entire Europe, EU commitment under the Kyoto Protocol. That's a lot of carbon saved, but we have to be very careful that compared to what we think as a business as usual, the overall carbon emission is still going up. Right. So otherwise, it will save this. So we calculated a similar number using a bottom-up approach. So basically, that's just confirming their data, for the three categories of policy, and for different the three categories of policy, and we give we're trying to allocate like 27% contributed by the top 1,000 program, and 29% the 10 key projects, and 22% from the small plant sort of closure program. That's for the manufacturing. For buildings, the buildings and transportation, these two consumption sectors are quite different than those two production sectors. We see the overall emission, this top figure, is going up very, very fast. But the efficiency improvement has been very modest. That means, but this is of a big concern, right? China is putting in a lot of new buildings. A lot of people say in the next 20 years, China is going to build just another USA. I mean, in terms of building volume. So therefore, the building efficiency, even though per square meter is not that high, but the volume increase is a very, very big factor driving the overall carbon emission from building sector. There are some good news. For example, in the district heating, because of the reform and the efficiency of district heating has improved very significantly. And that also helped to save a lot of energy for this sector. And building code, building China has the pretty good building code. And according to the government, 90% of the buildings, the new buildings, compliance level has been very high, more than 90%. But there are some problems in the design of the building code. So even though if you comply at 100% and because the design is not so good, then that can generate a big problem, right? For the buildings, if we split the energy consumption savings into different parts. So building codes, 40%, and that district heating, that 30%, and the rest of that being the renewable energy and appliances, the standard, and so on and so forth. The transportation sector has a similar, similar pattern. So if you look at the transportation sector, also the Chinese society now is learning from you guys, from the United States. Everyone wants to have their own car. Then energy consumption and the carbon emission is going up very, very fast. But the efficiency in the last 11th five-year plan has not been improving very, very quickly enough. So that another sign that's worrisome, a lot of people wants to take more flight and they want to drive cars rather than to take the public transportation, rather than to take the trains. So this transportation mode, the more energy consuming mode is shown in that five years. The good news is really in the agriculture sector. Agriculture is by far is the only sector in China that has an absolute reduction in energy use and CO2 emission. And also when we look at the other greenhouse gas species, the N2O and methane, and that's stayed more or less the same with a little bit decline in that period, but more or less stable. So agriculture is really the sector we see some good news. The forestry is another sector that is very interesting. Forestry, due to this large scale reforestation programs in China that's enacted in late 1990s, for other purposes, for purposes other than climate change. But now we see the impact in these 5 years, from 2006 and 2010. Each year we see just about 450 million tons of carbon dioxide being absorbed by the trees. So that is a really, really good news. Agriculture, we look at not just CO2, but also some other gas species and as well as the embodied carbon in machinery and fertilizer. So still putting all this together, you see the, agriculture and forestry are very, very good. Now, some key takeaways. The first one we see the carbon emission intensity has fallen, has been decreasing, but has been decreasing as a result of the energy intensity decreases, right? So it's not as a result of the energy mix, not really. Even though we see very significant increase of renewable energy in the last 5 years, but that did not contribute significantly to this carbon emission reduction. That also implies for the 12th five-year plan and the 13th five-year plan, then there is huge potential for looking at those renewable energy, non-fossil fuel energy options. Secondly, the most effective policies for China were top-down administrative measures. These measures, such as the target responsibility system. Let me just explain that a little bit. When you know all of this, right? There is a national target, and that target was disaggregated amongst all provinces and major enterprises. And the provincial leaders are told you have to get this down, right? In five years, 20%. Otherwise, you lose your job, right? I'm exaggerated a little bit, but basically that is what it is. It's administrative measures. These administrative measures are, in most times, are not cost effective, right? They are very expensive. And also, what is different for the last 5 years is these mandates were actually pretty well funded by the central government. In the past, it was not the case. The central government does have the mandates, but no funding. But in the last 5 years, it's a different story. So there are about 200 billion yuan was invested from the central government, and almost 2 trillion spent for the nationwide. So a lot of funding for this. Then, and because of this, the other parts, other instruments, particularly the market-based instruments and the legal instruments, the social, participatory, that kind of instruments were not important at all for the 11th five-year plan. And that is a problem for, having this very high cost. So therefore, we may say in one word or in one phrase, so the policies in the 11th five-year plan were effective, but not efficient. Now, also looking back, we see many of the low-hanging fruits are gone. And looking ahead is going to be extremely challenging for meeting a new target. The new target is lower. 16% for energy, 17% for carbon. Then, but still, it's going to be really, really hard for China to achieve. And now looking ahead for the 12th five-year plan, and we have heard in the news and the meetings, this is a low carbon green economy, right? It's very much emphasized by the national leaders. It sounds pretty much like a national consensus, but we have to wait to see. This is not necessarily the case for the provincial leaders or municipal leaders. I'll get back to this in just a little bit. Then China is trying hard to restructure the economy. However, the success rate of this has been remaining questionable. This emission reduction is emphasized for the 12th five-year plan for the first time. Not just energy efficiency, which is a good news. It's a great news. And also for the 12th five-year plan, we look at the consumption side management, not just the production. But we have to understand that just about two-thirds of all the energy consumed in China is on the production side, right? Another one-third is consumption. In the U.S., it's just about the opposite, right? Two-thirds on consumption and one-third on the production. All right, China is now looking at some other instruments, policy instruments, emission trade system, the cap and trade, is the pilots are just beginning this year, and we'll hear some specific design later this year. The energy performance contracting being a major instrument used, promoted by the central government, and also carbon tax is being looked at very seriously. So, it is possible that in the next year or two, we'll see some sort of a carbon tax being implemented as well as this ETS pilots. And, in certain provinces in the regions, the government is considering an absolute cap for coal consumption. So this is quite significant because I'll explain the reason. The reason is this: when we look at the 12th five-year plan, the 12th five-year plan specified not only that 16% cut in energy intensity, 17% cut in carbon intensity, but also it specified the GDP growth rate at 7%. All right, remember 7.5%. For the 11th five-year plan, and do we know what happened at the end of the 11th five-year plan? Is 11%, right? Then it's almost always the case. The 7% for the 12th. Then right now, when you compare the provincial plans, you can get very, very much higher than 7%. It does not really add up to that 7%. So the problem then is when we just look at the GDP growth, you specify the intensity target for energy and carbon, but the GDP is going, you know, way beyond what has been planned and specified, then that is a major challenge. Because of that challenge, now several places, several provinces and the regions are considering to have an absolute cap, right, rather than just the relative terms. Another challenge is the structure. The Chinese economy is driven mostly by two very important factors. Export, a lot of exports comes to the United States, and urbanization. Right? Urbanization has been going up really, really fast. 30 years ago, it was only 17% of the entire population living in the cities. And now it is just about one half of the population living in the cities. And it's going up very, very fast rate. Just about 1% a year. 1%, that means every year you see the 13 million people moving from the countryside into the cities. So these two factors are driving the economy. Therefore, for any kind of change in the structure is going to be really, really tough. But without that change in the structure, then it's really hard to control the growth rate of the CO2 emissions. And Professor Lieberthal can tell you more and better about this. Technology, international technology transfer is still a hot topic. It was a great topic. It was a very hot topic before. But the domestic R&D and deployment is probably even more of a problem for now. That provides another challenge. Financing for low carbon development, and how you can ensure that the money can be channeled into that direction is pretty tough challenge for policymaking. Finally, the market instrument has been talked about and but faces a huge challenges in implementation. So finally, I would like to end my talk with a few comments about these implications for U.S. and probably more of implications for U.S. and China cooperation. First is when we look at the size and the rate of growth of carbon emission for both U.S. and China, we are the two largest emitters. All right, then it doesn't really make that much difference to say who's the first or who's the second, but we are the two largest one, and we bear same kind of responsibility and the blames. So I think this is why this issue has to be addressed. Then the second one is the some of the accomplishment and the success in the 11th five-year plan you can say really comes from this strong leadership and commitment to address this issue. Before 2007, probably very few in the leadership cared that much, but afterward, that has been a really, really big issue in the top leadership. I think that really also need to be addressed here, you know, in this city, the political will and the leadership. Restructuring the economy and to a higher value, lower emission industry, and that is very important for the in terms of a carbon emission reduction, and it's also going to be extremely relevant for our two countries. Therefore, some of overarching top level design of the policies is really important, and really important for the two countries to look at this, you know, in more of a concerted way. And for the consumption sector, consumption side carbon emission is a key problem here in this country. Right, nobody wants to actually deal with it in the political world, and it is really a growing concern in China. You have to this is not going to be popular. Right, no political leader wants to intervene. The lifestyle of people, and I know that. The opportunities, finally, for best practice sharing in energy and in energy efficiency and carbon emission reduction, I think is very, very important, and that is what's going on between U.S. and China on clean energy cooperation. And many of you here have participated and helped design that program. Right now, I think it's going well, but we hope to have a larger scale for that collaboration. I want to end with this. You made optimistic, pessimistic tone. Then I look forward to the discussion later on. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. Yeah.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks, Ken, for asking me to come down, and it's a pleasure to respond to your report, Chie. You know, in this town, conversations about China's energy policy or action or inaction on climate change generally happens in fairly cartoonish ways, driven by people's domestic political priorities. So if you are interested in having the U.S. pass climate change legislation or deploy clean energy, then China is winning the race in clean energy and is about to wipe the U.S. off the map, and we're seeing our economic future vanish in front of us. And if you are not interested in seeing the U.S. pass climate change legislation, then it's all smoke and mirrors in China. They're doing nothing but building 100 gigawatts of year coal-fired power plants, and all those wind farms people talk about aren't plugged into the grid. Of course, neither of those extremes are correct. The truth lies somewhere in between. For China, like any other country, there's a broad mix of policy motivators behind energy efficiency or clean energy deployment, be it energy security, economic development, local air pollution, or climate change. And like other countries, China's figuring out in this kind of new area of policy what works and what doesn't. And so I commend Professor Chi and the folks at CPI for, instead of trying to throw one more study on the pile of what's China doing, what aren't they doing, they focus in their study on looking at which policies have been the most effective and the lowest cost. And ultimately, that's what leadership in Beijing is going to need going forward, is good independent analysis of what works and what doesn't in meeting policy objectives. So I commend you on the study, and it's worth picking up and reading. I think what I'll do with my time today is maybe add a little color on areas of the 11th five-year plan that didn't get as much attention in Professor Chi's remarks. And I'm going to talk a little bit about parts of the 12th five-year plan in the energy space and how they impact the U.S. So this is a kind of another version of a chart that Professor Chi showed you. So this is energy intensity of the Chinese economy going back to 1954. And as the professor noted, over the past three decades, there's been this dramatic decline in the energy intensity of the Chinese economy. Now, I would differ from Professor Chi a little bit here in that he ascribed most of that to active government efficiency policy. I think that was primarily the result of Beijing letting go of the economy, getting out of the way a little bit. That, you know, up until 1979, Mao Zedong was taking a country full of farmers and trying to make everybody make steel, like the Soviet Union, which had dramatic consequences for the energy intensity of the Chinese economy. Well, the rest of East Asia got rich doing light manufacturing, labor-intensive manufacturing, the stuff that we know China for today. Starting in 1978, Beijing, in the reform period, began to give firms and households more freedom to choose what they wanted to do for work. They gave state-owned enterprises profit incentive for the first time and started liberalizing energy prices. And so what we saw from 1978 to 2002 was a dramatic decline in energy intensity of the Chinese economy, because people went from making steel with no concern about energy costs because prices weren't liberalized and they didn't have a profit incentive, to making Barbie dolls and DVD players, and that requires a lot less energy than making steel does. But as Professor Qi noticed, in 2002 that reversed. Now, unless you think that this little blip right here is not, I mean, what's this? When we look in this whole history, this doesn't seem like a terribly significant blip. What's all the fuss about this little blip in Chinese energy intensity? If you look at the implications of that blip going forward, just that change, that little change between the relationship between energy demand and economic growth, it caused us to fundamentally revise our expectations about where China's going in the world, right? So if we go back to 2002, folks in Paris at the International Energy Agency or here in D.C. and planners in Beijing thought that maybe China would pass the U.S. sometime post-2030 in terms of total energy demand. Well, we moved that up by a couple decades. Today, the IEA's forecast for Chinese energy demand in 2030 is about 80% higher than it was just 5-6 years ago. So that's two Indias of today, or an India of 2030, is our kind of margin of error when we think about Chinese forecasting. That had significant implications for international energy markets. It put China on the map in global climate change talks in a way that they hadn't been before. And it focused leadership attention like a laser beam, like Professor Qi said, on bending that curve back down. Because this right here, that type of line, is catastrophic for China. There's no way the country meets its economic development goals with that type of resource intensity. There's just not enough resource availability in the world. Price pressures would be too large, et cetera. And so we saw the 11th five-year plan focus, as Professor Qi said, considerably on trying to bend that back down and improve energy intensity of the Chinese economy. And they were largely successful in meeting the 20% target. They did that almost entirely through technical efficiency. There's a couple of different ways that you can reduce the energy intensity of your economy. You can do the same set of things. So you can continue to make steel, aluminum, and cement. You can just do it more efficiently. Or you can change the mixture of things, right? It was that change in mixture that increased Chinese energy intensity from 2002 to 2006. And that's what this chart shows here. So this is industry as a share of the economy in China, which, you know, has been largely stable at kind of 45 to 50% since 1978. But within industry, the mix of industry that China does has changed dramatically, right? So from 1978 until 2002, China moved from heavy industry, steel, cement, aluminum, flat glass, into light industry. And then starting in 2002, they switched back into heavy industry, particularly what I call the E5, the five most energy-intensive industries, which is iron and steel, aluminum, cement and glass, refining, and basic chemicals. Those five industries combined account for about 45-50% of total Chinese energy demand in China. They are the energy story in China today, and it was the surge in production in those industries that gave us that big upside surprise in Chinese energy demand. So as you can see from this chart here, you know, since 2005, since the beginning of the 11th five-year plan, Beijing has not been very successful in rebalancing the economy away from those energy-intensive industries. They are still at about 24-25% of GDP today. And that's a problem. It does mean that there is significant opportunity going forward to deliver big improvements in energy intensity if that rebalancing story finally comes true. In 2007, we started to see this line change a little bit, and there were folks in the kind of China-watching community here in D.C. that were optimistic that Beijing might finally be rebalancing the economy. The renminbi was starting to appreciate. There was a lot of talk from leadership about increasing service sector activity and decreasing the amount of investment and exports in the economy. And then the financial crisis hit, and Beijing doubled down on an investment-led economic growth strategy to get through the crisis, opened up bank lending taps to infrastructure projects, which created lots of demand for steel, aluminum, and cement, the same sectors that increased energy intensity up until 2005, 2006. So the imperative to rebalance the economy, the Chinese economy, goes beyond just resource conservation. I mean, it is true that if China wants to develop its economy without straining its own and global resources, it will have to move away from heavy industry towards services. But that's not going to come at the expense of economic growth. That's actually what leadership needs to do to boost economic growth as well. So what I've done for you here is mapped out about 41 Chinese industries, treating the service sector as a single industry, based on $1 million renminbi of investment. On the x-axis is how much energy demand that million renminbi of investment creates. And on the y-axis is how many jobs it creates, right? So it's the energy intensity of industries versus the labor intensity of industries. And the size of the bubble is how much energy they consumed, 2007 through 2009, right? So if I'm a bank and I have a choice between investing a million renminbi in the iron and steel sector or investing a million renminbi in the service sector, if I invest a million renminbi in services, I create three times more jobs than in the iron and steel sector. And that investment will only create 2% of the energy demand than investment in the steel sector did. So if I take these, the E5, together, they together create about 14 million jobs a year. That's total employment in five industries that account for 45 to 50% of the country's energy bill. And as Professor Chi said, for a country that's needing to create 15 to 20 million new jobs each year to deal with rural to urban migration, that's a bad strategy. If you're resource constrained and desperate for new jobs, being the world steel mill is a losing strategy on a wide, in a wide variety of ways. And that's apparent to leadership. It's less apparent to provincial officials, but it is the reason for the focus on rebalancing in the current plan. To make this a little bit clearer, I've changed the bubble size here to employment instead of energy demand. Right, so service sector is about 250, 260 million jobs as opposed to the 14 million of all of those energy-intensive industries combined. So that's where the jobs are. Now, it's not, restaurants and hairdressing and investment bankers and lawyers, and it's not necessarily as sexy as, making steel, but that's really what an engine of job creation in a modern economy is. No offense to Jeff. I mean, digging iron ore and making steel is good economic activity, too. All right, so if we think about the energy intensity target for the next five-year plan, 16% compared to the 20%, now I'd agree with Professor Chi that most of the really low-hanging fruit, the really outdated backward power plants, the really outdated steel mills, stuff that's been hanging around. It's basically guys with, open fire pits and ladles making steel. That stuff's been backed out in China, right? And that resulted in a significant energy intensity improvement. So you don't get that anymore because that fruit's been picked, right? But keep in mind that China got that 19.1% without doing any structural adjustment in the economy, right? Just through technical efficiency, through some GDP revisions and a handful of other measures. So, people ask me, is a 16%, is that an easy target or a hard target? Well, depends entirely, right? If Beijing is successful in achieving their rebalancing goals for this next five-year plan, which is increasing service sector share of the economy, and then within industry, reducing heavy versus light, they will achieve that 16% with no improvement in technical efficiency at all. Right? It'll be very easy to do. But if rebalancing gets pushed off for another 5 years, it will be extremely difficult to hit that 16%. So basically, it's too hard to tell. And that's why reports like Professor Chi's that focus on the specific policies, what are you doing in energy efficiency, matter much more than focusing on is the headline target met or not. Because that will largely be a consequence of macroeconomic trends, that some of which are in Beijing's control and some of which are not. And most of which are not being driven primarily for energy reasons. The other significant energy-related target that was in President Hu's speech at the UN General Assembly in 2009 and has been embodied in the 12th five-year plan is to obtain 15% of all energy from non-fossil sources by 2020. And so the 12th five-year plan has the kind of first installment of that, 11.4% of energy from non-fossil sources. So, you know, what I did here is kind of gave you some context of what that could look like, assuming China meets its 16% energy intensity improvement for both this plan and then the next plan. And if GDP grows anywhere from 7%, which is the official target, and as Professor Chi said, you know, China watchers in the States used to, you know, we used to take the kind of official target and say, okay, well, 8%, what matters is if it was 8.5% in the previous plan and it's 8% now, then the most information we get from that is it signifies leadership intention to decelerate the economy. The ability of leadership to actually make GDP be what they want it to be is, of course, as limited in China as it is anywhere else. But it's useful signaling information. So, you know, there's kind of clearly an intent to decelerate growth in the current five-year plan from the previous five-year plan. I would be shocked if GDP actually came in at 7% for the next 5 years. So taking that as the lower bound and then taking the past 5 years where we saw 10% average annual growth as the upper bound and using as many of the publicly announced renewable targets in terms of capacity as I could find, kind of mapped out how much non-fossil energy capacity China would build, need to build, to meet those targets over the next decade versus what the U.S. is currently projected to build by the Energy Information Administration under business as usual. And then we did a model of a kind of notional cap and trade program and saw how much the U.S. would build under that, right? So kind of headline is at 7% growth to meet a 15% carbon non-fossil target, China would need to add 320 gigawatts of non-fossil energy capacity to the grid in the next decade. At 10% growth, they need to add 480 gigawatts. The U.S. is going to add 40 to 50 gigawatts under business as usual, and maybe 70 gigawatts if we actually pass comprehensive climate legislation, right? So between a third and a half of all non-fossil energy capacity would get built in China over the next decade if they were successful in actually meeting those targets. And here's some of the breakdown by technology. I'm not going to go into a lot of the challenges for reaching those targets. There are many. We can discuss them in the Q&A about specific technologies if people have an interest. I think I would be very surprised if Beijing was successful in meeting the kind of upper bound of this. That's just a dramatic expansion of capacity in a very short period of time. But even if they get halfway there, this will transform fundamentally the global market for clean energy technology, to be sure. Right? It'll change its price points. It'll change the relative economics of low-carbon technology versus high-carbon technology, and not just in China but other places. You don't have to look at things like the China price in Barbie dolls or DVD players to see how that could happen in solar panels and windmills. You can look at what happened in coal-fired power plants and other energy technologies. So, you know, between 2004 and 2010, China added on average 60 to 70 gigawatts of coal-fired power per year to the grid, a UK size of coal-fired power. And in the process of doing that, dropped the price of a coal-fired power plant from $2,000 per installed kilowatt to $500 per installed kilowatt, right? If you see anything like that price trend happen in non-carbon, low-carbon technology, then that'll significantly change the economics. But what's really interesting about China is that while they're adding 320 to 480 gigawatts of low-carbon technology, they'll also be adding 400 to 500 gigawatts of coal-fired power capacity, right? China's very unique in its ability to be the price setter of both of those technologies at exactly the same time. This is an IEA forecast, the kind of rosy new policy scenario IEA forecast. We all kind of join together and address climate change and enact all our policy ambitions. And even there, you know, China's adding about a U.S. worth of coal-fired power capacity over the next decade. So, since finishing my, you know, one-year stint in D.C. that felt like two-year stint in D.C., and returning to New York, where I deal with firms and the financial sector, trying to understand how is China's energy sector evolution going to impact energy prices in the U.S., the value of companies in the U.S. and Europe, this is the largest question right now, I would say, about China's energy future, is what exactly that coal mix looks like. And that's going to be driven in large part by what happens to those non-fossil targets as well as what happens to growth. And this is why it matters. Everybody knows the China oil import story, right? 1993, China becomes a large net importer of oil. And then By 2004, 2005, we have this surge in Chinese demand that drives up prices in international oil markets, and oil watchers around the world start paying very close attention to what's happening in China. We're starting to see that happen in coal, too. Never really considered to be a globally traded commodity in the way oil is, but is increasingly becoming so in large part because of China. In 2009, China became a net importer of coal for the first time in its history in a real way. Now, net imports still only account for about 4 to 5% of Chinese coal consumption. But 4 to 5% of 50% of the world's coal consumption is a pretty big number in absolute terms, as shown on the inset here. So China's imports in 2010 of coal, 166 tons, is about the same as what Japan imports or EU imports. But if you look at the swing, China's net export position in 2005 to net import position in 2010, that's 260, 270 million tons, which is like taking out all of Australia's coal exports or Indonesia's coal exports. It's left a gigantic hole in the Asian coal market that's fed through into the European coal market, into the U.S. coal market. And that's impacted prices for coal in the U.S. here in the same way that that China's impacted prices for oil. So this is a U.S. price index, and we have natural gas, which has seen this dramatic decline in price because of shale. Gas is the most localized fossil fuel in the U.S. now, versus oil and coal, which are increasingly globalized. And so this is, you know, you can kind of imagine these prices continuing under the fairly rosy picture of subdued Chinese coal demand because China is successful in actually meeting its non-fossil energy targets. But the problem is, if you think about the different GDP growth forecasts for the next 10 years, and you couple that with prospects of China meeting its non-fossil energy target, then you get in 2020 about a, this is in million tons of coal, million tons of oil equivalent, so times divided by 0.7. This would be about 1 billion tons of coal is the swing here in 2020 of demand. Now, that's the bounds are China grows at 7% and only meets a 10% non-fossil target. China grows at 10%, only meets a 10% non-fossil target. Sorry, this is 15% non-fossil. That's 10% non-fossil, right? So the difference between those two is a billion tons of coal demand, right? It's a massive, massive amount of uncertainty just a decade out, right? These projects take a long time. Maybe Jeff can tell us how long it takes to kind of plan a large coal infrastructure project. But to have a billion tons of global coal demand uncertainty a decade out is a big issue. It's a big issue. And it'll impact the price of power here in the U.S. because people can't adequately plan capacity. And my concern is, and I'd be interested if Professor Chi, if you have any thoughts on this in the Q&A, is that, you know, like I said, with the GDP targets, you know, we always assume nobody in China really takes them seriously, right? It's sentiment. But when you look at the non-fossil targets, they are, when you look at the capacity announcements for 2020, they are assuming 7% GDP growth, right? So my question is, if I'm in Beijing, if I'm at the NDRC, am I only approving coal mines and coal-fired power plants based on an assumption of 7% growth and an assumption that I'm actually going to be able to meet that 15% non-fossil target? Because if that's true, then we're looking at a gigantic push into import markets for coal from China in the next 5 to 10 years with some pretty significant impacts for prices in the U.S. So with that, lots of work for CPI in the years ahead. Glad you'll be doing it. Keep us updated on what you learn. We'll be very eager to know what our power price in Ohio is going to be. So,
we're waiting for the mic to be turned on, which should be momentarily. Is this on now? Okay, good. First of all, thank you very much for enormously rich presentations. As you all can imagine, being able to sit there and really go through these slides in detail would be extremely informative. I'm delighted to say that both of our presenters have agreed that we can post their slides on our website, so we will have them up within a day or so, and they'll be available to you. I want to open it up for Q&A in just a moment. When I do, let me ask that you raise your hand when you're identified. Please say your name, what your affiliation is, and please ask a question. You know it's a question because it ends in a question mark, right? And so please be short and clear and make it a question. We'll have roving mics and wait until the mic comes to you before you ask your question. I'm going to ask just one question before we open it up, and that is as follows. Trevor stressed that the savings, the 16% target for the 12th five-year plan will be relatively easy to reach if the anticipated rebalancing, structural rebalancing in the economy occurs, going to be very tough if it does not occur. My question for Chiet is it going to occur? And especially, what is your thinking behind your bottom line answer?
Well, let me first say, I think the rebalancing of the economy, which is really the key right now for the entire 12th five-year plan, is going to be a really, really challenging job. When you just look at the opening year this year for the 12th five-year plan, the almost every trend that we see now is telling us the opposite. So I think if that is indeed the case, and combined with Trevor's argument, then we'll see that 16% is going to be really, really challenging to answer that question. I think the just like what we saw last year for meeting the target, the 20% target, the May 2010, when the central government realized there is a huge challenge to achieve the 20% target, then they acted very quickly and very forcefully. So I would like to see that kind of determination. However, I see there has to be better ways than that kind of campaign style measures to reduce it. So I want to, you know, since we still have 4.5 years to go, 90% of the time, so I would like to remain optimistic.
Okay. In principle.
In principle.
I mean, core to this, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the operational incentives for territorial leaders from the province on down, province, city, county, township, remain to maximize GDP growth year after year. That generally is most easily done by capital-intensive investments, which generate jobs. I mean, there's just all kinds of good things to them if you look at it from the perspective of that territorial leader. But that runs in directly in the face of rebalancing. So unless you can change those incentives in a really significant way, you don't change the operational behavior. But especially during a period of political succession, it's extremely hard to spend a lot of political capital changing those incentives. So you're probably waiting until 2014 or so, after the new leadership is coming and been in place for a year or so, to kind of get consolidated before you can anticipate major measures in that regard. Is that right?
No, I totally agree with you. I think the incentives are really the key for the incentives for provincial and local government officials and the local governments in general is really the key here. However, I do want to note that the incentive structure changed considerably. I liked your overall description. You know, what's going on. I think the 11th five-year plan was the 5 years that we saw the considerable change in that the mix of the incentives, the structure of the incentives. Take environment, for example, right? Not only we see the weighting factors for performance evaluation in the central government rules, but also there are a number of other, changes for the pollution reduction, not really in this, energy, saving, but for the pollution reduction part, that really changed quite considerably. I also agree with you that for the last 5 years, it's probably easier to change because, you know, with this the political, what was the administration, you know, no major change in the administration. But for this 5 year plan, it may pose us a much bigger challenge in improving the incentive structure.
Good, thank you. Let me open the floor. Yes, sir.
We're back here. The first gentleman with his hand up. Come toward me. No, two more rows, two or three. That, right there. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Stan Tsai from OCA, Organization of Chinese American DC Chapter. My question to Professor Key is, we know in here we always talk about government control or market-driven, which way is an effective way, okay? And I think you talk about everything about a policy from the government. I'd like to know if energy price change in recent year and also in China, if China's energy price change a lot, is it possible drive the, you know, the energy consumption efficiency better? Thank you.
Thank you for that's a great question. Actually, you know, for any kind of study on policy effective analysis, that's one of the fundamental challenge that we face. It's really hard to sort, you know, which is more fundamental than the other one. And for the case of 11th five-year plan, we believe the and from our analysis, we believe it's the policy that this top-down administrative measures were really the key to drive the energy consumption. However, I want to note in some different sectors, sectors related to the consumption side, for example, some sectors that it's more sensitive to the price changes. Well, that can attribute to the market forces. But unfortunately, we didn't give a quantification, you know, which part contributes by how much. We didn't really do that. But adding that to my comments, it's because of this top-down administrative measures, so that makes the whole thing very expensive. So we would hope for the next five-year plan and later and beyond, then we have more of a role played by the market.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that one of the most useful findings from Professor Chi's study is that, you know, the things that worked in the last plan aren't going to work so much going forward. And I think electricity pricing is key to that. So if you look at the renewable energy deployment targets, for example, adding wind capacity by the way that wind has been incentivized in China is that there's a feed-in tariff. So if you generate wind and you do it to spec, the grid has to buy it, and they have to buy it at a premium, right? Now, because of concerns about inflation, NDRC has not increased residential or industrial power prices specifically to compensate those renewable energy producers. Now, if you're talking about wind being 1% of generation, then the state grid will take the hit to be a good corporate citizen. It's not a big issue. If you're talking about renewables being, you know, 20%, 30% of power generation in some provinces, there's no way you can successfully incentivize that deployment and get full cost recovery both to the producers and to the grid without fundamentally rethinking electricity pricing. It's a challenging structural issue in China that they were able to kind of dodge the past 5 years, and I think they're going to have to tackle head on if the fairly lofty ambitions in the next plan are going to be met.
If I can just add to that, the price of coal has gotten high enough that a lot of power plants are no longer producing at full capacity because they're losing money with every kilowatt hour that they generate. So, again, the authorities are kind of caught between do you contribute to inflation by raising electricity prices to consumers of electricity, or if you aren't willing to do that, how do you make this a profitable operation for power generators? And so, you know, these things are just – there are no simple solutions to any of this. Yes, right back here.
I'm Sally Rand. I'm with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. We do a lot of work in the non-CO2 greenhouse gas area and sharing best practices with China. I was wondering if Dr. Chi or Trevor could expand on either work that you've done or knowledge that you expect through the next five-year plan that will focus on the non-CO2 gases?
Well, one of the recent study we are doing is to work with the Ministry of Environmental Protection to review the pollution reduction policy for the 11th five-year plan. I think that's well, unfortunately, these two are divided into two agencies, one in Ministry of Environment and the other one is NDRC, which they're treated in one agency. Also, EPA has a great collaboration with MEP in China on this. I see the MEP, the pollution reduction policy, were better implemented and achieved more in terms of achieving its target. So I see for the 12th five-year plan, since now we have two more pollutants added to that, and it's going to be a lot more challenging. Then no major new policy innovation so far ever since 2007 on that. So I think it's going to be very challenging for the next 5 years.
Yes, I've decided to stand up so the people can see who I'm pointing to be recognized. Right over here, this gentleman. Yes.
Lawrence McDonald, Center for Global Development. Thanks for terrific presentations, and thanks, Dr. Lieberthal, for organizing this. My question has to do, Dr. Chi, you mentioned the importance of leadership. And as you know, in the United States now, we have one of our major parties, basically, where climate denial has become the new ideology. And I'm wondering about the interaction between that climate denial and the highly politicized nature of the climate debate in the United States and Chinese policy. Is China going to pursue these policies for its own reason regardless of the U.S. position, or is there some sort of a feedback between policies pursued in the United States and those in China? Thanks very much.
Well, that's a great question. We actually looked at that question a couple of years back, and we look at all these achievements that China has achieved in the last five or so years, it's really driven by domestic concerns rather than by this global climate change. We can all count that into climate change response, but really it's driven by domestic concerns. Therefore, looking ahead for this coming 5 years, still I think the domestic concern, the driver, will play the major role. Therefore, I think what's going on inside China is going to continue to drive the climate policy in the next 5 years. However, as an independent scholar, we would like to see leadership all over the world, particularly here in the U.S., right? But I think the Chinese response is from the domestic factors, right?
Yeah, I guess I'd add, I think that's generally true. 90%, let's say, 95% of the impetus is domestic concerns, climate change being least on the list, right? So energy security, local environmental pollution, supply diversification, et cetera. That said, nobody likes being the biggest emitter in the world. We've been the biggest emitter in the world for a long time, and we're happy to pass that mantle on to someone else. And I think the past couple of years has been a little bit of a wake-up call for Chinese leadership in terms of what type of reputational risk there is internationally in this space. How China's viewed, are they being a responsible participant or not, matters at the margin, particularly if it looks tough to meet some of these domestic policies, raising the cost of failure so that there's not just a domestic cost of failure, but there's an international reputational cost of failure. That cost of failure is completely non-existent without any action from the U.S. The paralytic state of U.S. energy policy is a Christmas gift for Chinese leadership in terms of international pressure on climate change.
We've now got the banner headline from this presentation, the paralytic state of U.S. Yes, ma'am, Rebecca. Yeah. The microphone's right there. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Laurie Johnson from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Just two quick questions. I would like to see what the speakers have to say about the scramble for competition for jobs and the clean energy race and so forth. And then the other, Trevor, if you could say a little more about increases in coal prices, I think that's what you were getting at, from globalization, and what impact that might have in energy markets in the U.S.
I liked very much Trevor presented in the perspective, you know, looking at this, the energy, the restructuring of the Chinese economy, considering the urbanization as a opportunity or as a pressure for creating jobs. I very much like that perspective. I think I liked from Trevor's presentation is it distinguishes between the national central government leaders and provincial and local government leaders. They treat that quite differently. So in both job creation and energy saving and climate change response, I think that one of the top priorities for the national government. Not necessarily the same kind of priority for the provincial leaders. So as Ken just talked about, if you rank the job creation, GDP creation, you know, other things, this probably does not really come to very top for the local leaders, but it is very serious challenge for the national leaders. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, I worry. I think that to be frank, the narrative that we're going to create enough local demand in the U.S. relative to global scale to get first mover advantage, create manufacturing ecosystems here so we can dominate in clean energy is like 5 years too late. I mean, it's very difficult, even under an ambitious domestic policy scenario, it's difficult seeing that type of manufacturing ecostructure across the low carbon spectrum showing up here. That's not to say that we aren't going to be competitive in parts of that value chain, in particularly IP intensive, capital intensive parts of the clean energy value chain. I think we can be competitive, and domestic policy is certainly going to help increase that competitiveness. But the market for this stuff is going to be in China and other places, even if we get our act together here. What's interesting about that is, you know, if you imagine a decline in non-fossil technology prices, anything like we've seen in coal-fired power in China or in light manufactured goods, in PV and wind and biofuels in the years ahead, coupled with what will continue to be very constructive Chinese demand pressures on coal prices, I think the relative economics of low carbon versus high carbon energy in the U.S. are going to change significantly relative to what we're thinking of them being today. And the interesting thing about that is that actually gets the more successful China is in achieving its targets, the greater that is, right? I mean, the more successful China is in meeting non-fossil targets, the more likely it is that those prices are going to be competitive here in the U.S. The faster the Chinese economy grows, that means more non-fossil technology and more coal demand, which then further kind of pushes those divides. And I don't think that's, you know, when those of us in the kind of modeling community, when we do technology cost curves, when we kind of look at energy system transformation, we're looking at kind of Western experience, not Chinese economies of scale, China price experience. And I think once you start factoring that in, it can change things in pretty significant ways. Well, in the U.S., I mean, what will happen first, of course, as China drives up coal prices is gigantic switch to natural gas, right? Just because the timing is not right for low carbon. In China, there are very, folks generally focus on the energy efficiency targets and on the non-fossil energy targets. The natural gas targets in the five-year plan are very ambitious as well, going from 4% to 8%, I think, of primary supply. There is a lot of conventional gas in China, onshore China. There is the prospect of a lot of shale gas, maybe 2015 and beyond. For the next decade, That gas is primarily going to go to residential, industrial, and commercial use, where the tariff is higher and where it's competing against LPG and other oil derivatives that are very expensive. So we're not going to see a large role for gas in the power sector, I think, in the next decade. But post-2020, that could definitely change. You could see large-scale coal gas switching after 2020.
We're generating a lot of answer now. We'll only please keep it very short because we've only got 5 minutes left. So, yeah.
Doug Dias from the University of Maryland. As an economist, your reference to carbon tax, of course, appeals, I think, a lot to economists, but not so much to the bureaucratic capitalists in Beijing. What role do you see in the next 5-year plan for carbon taxes, which could be used to compensate consumers and households for increased electricity costs and so on?
Okay, carbon tax in the 12th 5-year plan? You mentioned that in passing.
I mentioned that, yes. The carbon tax is a vague term. It can include a number of different things. We don't have carbon tax right now. But there is a discussion about implementing a carbon tax in next year or two. So but there are things that, you know, can be classified, categorized as carbon tax, a fuel tax, for example, can be. So that is already there. Then for the 12th 5-year plan, I do not really see the carbon tax per se, you know, the narrow. Narrowly defined, is going to play a major role in bringing down the energy intensity and carbon intensity. But because it's only at the experimenting phase. But if the carbon tax is in place for the next year or two, then the next 5 years, the 13th, that should play a very, very important role. And they are actually, the carbon tax and the cap and trade, as economists, you know this well, are going to target on very different things, right? You know, one probably primarily on production side, and the other one on some other categories. So, but to say it simply, I don't think it's going to play a major role the 12th five-year plan, right?
Yes,
Kelvin Tu with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. When we talk about energy intensity in China, we're talking about two indicators, energy and GDPs. Currently, if we add China's energy or GDP at the provincial level, they are both much higher than the national figures. So if I am a head of a provincial government, I can simply underreport energy consumption and overreport the GDP figures to meet the government target for the 12th 5-year plan, which is actually very difficult to avoid under China's statistical connection system. So how to avoid that, how to verify the energy intensity reduction is real in the future? Okay. Thank you.
So the issue is verification of reporting. Yep.
Let me do this directly. Thank you, Kevin. The GDP reporting, there is a disincentive for reporting GDP and higher GDP simply because that is related very directly to the pollution reduction. The pollution reduction is the target is calculated on your GDP. The amount of pollution is just a multiply factor than on the GDP. So there is a disincentive there. If you're reporting that one, you can achieve the energy target, but you're going to lose on the pollution target. That being said, November 2007, there was a national policy implemented. It was for data collection, monitoring and performance evaluation for GDP. For energy intensity. That has been implemented for the last couple of years, and it's being revised to fix the possible loopholes on that. I think in general, the provincial wide, that is, that should not be a problem because the calculation is pretty easy to do. For the municipal level or county level is going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem. It's not that easy to get the number right.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's all the reasons internally why China needs to come up with a robust verification system if provincial performance and governor review is going to be based on success. Externally, I'm less concerned about our ability to verify whether a 16% carbon intensity target is hit or not for a couple reasons. GDP is a soft statistic everywhere. It's particularly soft in China in a statistical system that was production-based, right? I mean, it was used to kind of counting things that state-owned enterprises did, which means by definition it undercounted the service sector, right? And so we're seeing series of statistical revisions that are starting to get a better hold on service sector activity. And that's going to continue. GDP is going to continue to get revised. It's not a robust statistic at an absolute level. What matters more, I think, is some of what Professor Chi focused on in his report is looking specifically at policy effectiveness, right? So how much is the technical efficiency in steel mills improving? Because that's more concrete to assess. How much is building efficiency improving? How much of that is attributable to policy? Those are the things as an outside observer that I want to look to see is China actually taking action? In large part because if China rebalances its economy in the ways that I mentioned, it'll help reduce energy demand in China. It will increase energy demand in other places because that nth steel mill or cement kiln is going to get built somewhere to meet Chinese demand. Might get built in the U.S. South with cheap power from the Tennessee Valley Authority. It might get built in Brazil next to iron ore mines. So from a global climate standpoint, it doesn't tell you that much about how much closer you are to the prize.
Unfortunately, our time is up. I do have one question to wrap up that could probably have a two-word answer to it, but so let me ask it, which is we've been told repeatedly that a hard criterion for evaluation of provincial-level leaders is how they performed on the energy efficiency targets in the 11th five-year plan. Is there any provincial leader who has verifiably lost his job because of poor performance on energy?
Not as I know, Ken. No. But you are really, you know, the world expert on this issue. Is provincial leaders are more of a political leaders, right? Their promotion or their use on the job is evaluated in many different ways, more political than the lower level governmental officials.
Yeah. Right? So, but my concern is that when it's described as a hard target, but somehow never becomes hard enough to cost a job, it's a different kind of
animal. No, I look at it differently, yeah. Ken. That requirement should be there, right? Then the provincial leaders can pass that pressure to the lower level, which, you know, that they can hold them accountable, the mayors accountable. I mean, if the mayors can achieve that, the target, normally they have a higher target, then that it will make easier for the political leaders to achieve their job. It feels differently, but I think it should need to be there. Right.
Thank you very much. This is an enormously rich topic. We could spend a long time on it. I want to remind you that these slide sets will be available on our website. They contain just a tremendous amount of information. I want to thank both Trevor Hauser and Professor Chi Ye for coming and giving us this morning.